Hello, and welcome to episode 25 of the AI Infrastructure Podcast with me, Kai Hendry, in the UK, Southwest UK to be exact, and my co-host, Vincent de Smet, over in Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh City, I believe. We're both infrastructure engineers by day, and in the bright and early in the morning here, I am an AI enthusiast. In this podcast, you can expect us talking about AI and infrastructure. What does it all mean? And I hope you enjoy it. Do please comment. Do please like. Do please subscribe. And we're trying something new today. We're trying Riverside. So do tell us what you think of the recording. Is it better than the typical Zoom recordings that we've been doing up until now? You tell us. Thank you and enjoy.
Hey, how are you? Having a good day?
I just woke up, really. There's a lot to cover. It is almost overwhelming every time we meet because, like, there's a few things I want to cover. Mm. And I'm like, where's Vincent on this? Where's Vincent on that? I mean, yeah, what about yourself?
I had a lot of fun from, like, in the last 4 days using the tool that I built because I haven't had the opportunity to play with it and I had some time to play with it, and it just feels so good to see how it has evolved, what features has been added, what works, what doesn't work. I also played with Riverside, like you. Actually, basically because you sent me the message, I was like, okay, let me try it. And it was pretty fun.
Yeah, well, I'm desperate to improve the production quality and try different things, actually. So, well, here we are, trying different things. So cool. So your tool is SpecLedger or something?
No, it was SpecLedger. So basically, there were a couple of annoyances that I had filed, and then they had fixed it, and I wanted to see if the fixes were there. I think one of the things I might have mentioned is that we were suffering some quality issues, right? Even though that we were using the spec-driven development, and I had very good results with it. Once we scaled it out over a team with people of different experiences, I felt that even though we had team alignment on what to implement, there were still, when I finally got the implementation done by other people, areas where I discovered, hey, that's not done. This is not done. Mm. And so I felt like we talked a lot about how do you validate, how do you ensure that the AI implements. And I always talked about, yeah, you know, you need to build those validation, you know, testing around it. And then the thing that I have was completely failing. So I was like, what the hell?
So how are you doing it in a team? Because I can't help but think all this, the quality assurance is getting back to basics. Like, you know, my employer preaches shift left, preaches having a dedicated QA person on the team.
Yeah, so
it emphasizes quality. So as a team, you can't just expect AI to do the quality, right? You have to have someone responsible or playing the role of a tester or something?
I felt the hardest thing is when you are writing quite detailed and maybe too large of a user stories is how I only find out maybe a week later, like, hey, I remember I put some requirement there and when I'm using it, it turns out it's not there. So then I get frustrated, like, how did that not get there? Like, in terms of verifying it, it felt very random and gave me like a lot of doubt about the quality. But when I started playing with it, I actually realized that none of the quality guards that are built into SpecKit were properly initiated. So I had not initiated the repository, and so we were missing the constitution. We didn't have proper checklists. We didn't have a proper design. Like,
well, it sounds like you're in that sort of waterfall mindset where you're saying, like, the reason we had this quality issue was because our spec was wrong.
No, it's the validation wasn't there. One of the things that I put in the constitution is that a quick start document, in this case for a CLI, must document the user stories in it's a command line interface. So it must show user story one, you invoke the command line with this parameter, then this needs to happen. And that directly must translate to a formal like test in the test. So that I had that in my own project, but I noticed it was missing. We didn't have like these tests there.
All right. So the tests are not dropping out of the AI isn't following instructions.
No, the problem is the instructions were missing.
Really?
I had not initiated this, and the constitution was still empty. I thought it was filled out, so it has no principles. So there was no rule for the AI when it finishes the thing and then validates the task list. Maybe you can say that's because I thought like waterfall plan wasn't right, but it's very important because the final phase, which is the validation and testing and polishing phase, needs to have a task that validates it. And a lot of the times the task was manual verification instead of, and that's because it wasn't configured properly. And so basically what I did for the weekend was exfiltrate what I had done in my own project, where I have a very strong test suite, and basically copied over the principles into this one. Because I showed you the grid, right? I showed you that I have full playwright workflows. In this case, it's not just a CLI, it's actually a web interface with key
And
cloak
you're running a test
authentication.
suite.
I'm running everything there, and I had no quality problems, but I was also doing it alone, right? So that means I was defining the plan and I was also driving the implementation. In a team setting, you might only be involved in defining the plan, but you're not driving the implementation. And then you find out the person that did the implementation didn't actually validate
Yeah,
it.
so it makes me think that you need to be there for the whole process. You can't
I
be
don't
there
want to
for
be there
one.
for the whole process, right? So I am trying to solve that problem because
Why don't you want to be there for the whole process? Because it's tedious? Is there some reason?
we individually must own each feature that we're working on. Like, there's basically a team exercise where humans decide and collaborate on what is it that we want to implement, and then it's an individual and ideally not even a human involved, purely AI agent implementation, right? So today we are letting juniors drive that implementation process. I don't know if that's a good thing or if it's a bad thing. Maybe they are distracting the agent and therefore the agent did deliver, but I don't think that's a problem. I think they are letting the agent implement and they're not stopping it when it diverges. And that's a problem. I don't want a human to be there in the end to stop it when it diverges. I want it to be so straightforward that when the agent is done, the output works.
So
I don't want to be there for that implementation.
why doesn't so essentially you're saying that the junior is not catching the divergence or something like this,
Yeah.
and then you're going back to the drawing board to make sure the AI doesn't diverge. It sounds like that sort of thing is
Yeah,
happening.
and I think the contributing factor is that the junior is actually not very much involved in the planning process. They're
Yeah.
just, but it's not even on juniors only. We even have like a very big user story. Like we had too many, like 10, and we split them off into the individual ones. But we had aligned on the 10 big user stories, and we realized this is way too big of a scope to try and go into implementation. So we split it off in three smaller work streams of three each, one of four. And I let the end in execution by a scene like a more experienced person. And we still had things where, hey, the original 10 user stories had a detail here that was not captured. It could have been lost when it was split, or
Yeah.
it could have been lost during the implementation. So even the split, I should have been involved. But yeah, it's just.
It's tricky. I guess you're trying to scale with the help of AI, and
Yeah. And
you're
that's why
running
I
into
really
classic
enjoy.
problems.
Exactly. That's why I really love this project, because it's really a real true test of scaling out spec-driven development across a team of different skilled people.
So, on that note, let me just share something that I thought was really awesome.
And I say different skilled people, but I also found mistakes that I made, by the way. It's not like.
Yeah, I mean the last podcast or the podcast before last, I was actually like in shock about a bug that came through into, well, it didn't go into production, thank God, but
That you feel that the workflow would have easily been found out if you had paid closer attention.
if we just did it the traditional way, it would have never got through. But of course, I was like giving the PR to a colleague to review, and the problem was is that the colleague trusted me and I trusted the AI, and then this bug got through. So the whole trust thing, and I felt it wasn't so much that I put the bug through. It's also that now my colleague thinks I'm an idiot, for want of a better word, because I let a trivial bug through, and now he's lost confidence in me because I didn't review, I didn't see this AI introduced issue. I mean, I'm feeling like I'm blaming AI, but it was really me that was
But
doing the wrong thing.
I don't know how much data it had to, like you had, like was it part of a huge chunk and therefore it flew, or did you really just not give it? Damn, Kai.
Anyway, quality, I feel like we can talk about quality for days, but this blog, I think, is very succinct on the topics. He starts off by saying that every time you have a review, it makes you 10 times slower. And of course, PR reviews, we all know they suck, but they are a quality gate, right? And he was pointing that the more reviews you have, like I'm in some heavily regulated environments, and it takes like two approvers to get something in. And what he's saying here doesn't sound insane, but it definitely accumulates about how reviews take a long time. And then he makes a very interesting point to say that AI can't fix this. And like just like what we talked about, like a lot of people are creating these AI flywheels or AI harnesses or orchestrations where like, oh, doesn't this sound like you right now in some way, Vincent? Like, whoa, I
Like
have this prototype.
at least
We
a month ago.
yeah, exactly. But the prototype is getting busy, buggy,
Buggy.
sorry. We need to tell AI to fix this problem.
I didn't say I need to let AI fix it. I said I want a formal validation framework
Yeah, that's
around
true.
AI.
Sorry, I am making this a meal of this dramatization, but like I think you get the point here is that a lot of people are getting into this like trap where like AI caused the problem, but maybe I can get AI to fix the problem, and then now we have different sorts of problems.
Absolutely. This is what I also said to my friends. I mean, the fact that we have this problem, and we know that because we are taking something and we're scanning it out of a team, and clearly the quality is a problem. So we need to solve it. And that's definitely what's going to be the focus of the next few months, which is the validation mechanisms of the AI output. Because everybody's on board with SDD now, right? I mean, it's going all over the place. My friends are constantly sharing. Singapore GovTech is doing a trial of it. Other organizations
Oh,
are trialing it.
spec-driven development. Oh, okay,
Yeah,
yeah.
spec-driven development. That's kind of like being adopted everywhere,
But
right?
I feel that the problems that you just talked about, like that you wrote the spec, but then somewhere down the line there was a quality lapse or some junior didn't understand, like
The whole purpose of SDD is to catch this. And I know for a fact that my friend wrote a blog post talking about how vibe coding creates all these problems and how spec-driven design solves them. And I tell him, like, I
But
wouldn't write it.
surely, if we rewound the clock 20 years back, I'm sure some waterfall IBM proponent would have said the same thing about his specs. He would have said, like, oh yeah, if the spec would have caught that problem because we would have done the upfront design. What about the whole agile thing
No,
where we have loops?
this is not the problem that I'm saying that there is, right? I'm saying the spec clearly defined it this way and the implementation does not align. I'm not saying the spec wasn't properly designed. I never said that. I said the spec was very clearly defined, but the implementation doesn't match the spec. The agent
Okay.
took liberties. And then the funny thing is, when I see the agent take liberties when I'm in driving it, I stop it and I ask it why. And oftentimes there's a very good reason. Sometimes it was because the task description said one thing, and the original plan, like the very first functional requirement in the spec, said something else. And the agent says, spec rules all. So I went with the spec. And the reason that the task definition was different, because halfway through research, when it filtered down into the task, I made a change and I didn't back update it into the spec. Something like that. That's one
Okay,
case where
so
I
something
know.
wrong with the process.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's because I didn't do the full cross task plan and spec validation, because I do skip that one sometimes, which also made me think like, hey, we need to make sure we need to keep a flag to see if somebody at least once has run that validation or verification thing, which is a very extensive read-only cross artifact validator that you can use different models. I used to run those on Codex when I always ran out of tokens. Today,
So,
I don't really
okay,
switch
yeah, so
models.
use different models.
I don't think different models is required. It was just because I ran out of tokens. But
But
yeah, but that's just one case where the implementation diverges. I want to give you one more example, which is, and now I'm forgetting it. So one was that the task and the plan did not align. The second one that I've seen is that the plan says we can use this library this way, and then the agent says it doesn't work. Well, let me go back and simplify this or something like that, right? You see it happen, right? You make a plan with the agent, it reads the docs of the library, it decides to do things a certain way, and then finally when it's implementing, it doesn't work, and then sometimes Cloud Code goes like, well, you know what? This is too complicated. Let me simplify it. And then that no, stop. So I stopped it and I asked it very clearly, what is the problem? And it's totally valid, right? It's totally valid. But the biggest problem is the agent just keep going instead of stopping and saying like, hey, plan doesn't work. And it's very hard to define when are we okay with the agent stopping and when are we not okay with the agent stopping, because ideally we want like a Ralph Wiggum type of loop that keeps going until the task is complete, right? So
Yeah,
yeah, so
I
that's the
definitely
problems
feel
that I
that there's
see.
different philosophies here. Like I'm definitely more in the like just chat to it camp,
Just chat
and
with it, yes, but you don't want to be in the loop the whole time. Maybe it's good, right? Maybe it's like, yay, we still have a job.
yeah. Well, I just feel like the small iterations get to the solution better than going back to step one in a sense.
So you could argue that the spec was too large and it should have broken down more. You could argue that, don't do spec-driven development and vibe. I don't agree with that. But you could say if you do spec-driven development, really scope down. And that, to be honest, is one of the principles I put in the Constitution now, which is shortest spot to MVP, short-lived branches, scope down, scope down, scope down. Like, do not, it's all Yagni. You ain't gonna need it. Nothing that has a clear use case should ever be included in the implementation plan.
So I'm just highlighted agent framework, and I can't help but have this thought that like, what is the difference between a spec-driven development that you're creating and an agent framework? Because surely, the difference is not a lot of difference there, or it can easily be construed as a framework, couldn't it?
I'm not sure, but to me, when you start talking about agents and what the majority of like articles I read are doing, they're looking at like agent teams and personas and all that. I don't want to go there. I don't want to look at like agents completely individually doing all the work. I think you need to have a way to define the work. You need to have a way to really, master and manage what the work is. Because I mean, a lot of these teams that are saying, "Oh, we have a linear board with issues, and we just assign it to our swarm of agents, and they work on it, and then we get a working solution." Either maybe that their SDD, spec-driven development, is basically their classic product owners and engineers defining the actual ticket down to a very small task that an agent can complete. And yeah, I mean, if you do that, that's perfect, right? But I'm focused on that life cycle part, like taking it. So the whole like agent framework and individual working, again, like I said, I don't want to be in the driver's seat, but I very much feel I have to be right now. And to me, it feels like I want to control the task definitions and how the work goes into the agent framework. That's where I'm focused on.
So the other thought, because this is applicable to a problem I have at work right now, is documentation. So your spec, is that?
It's not a documentation.
It's not the documentation.
No, I had the same, and it's a very good question that I did a session with my friend. I said, hey, basically what I'm doing is I'm giving people the chance to give me some projects that they want to work on, and I use my Cloud Code agent tokens, and I spend 2 hours, and we have to complete it within 2 hours, and I'll give you a working solution. So I initialize the repository with, or you give me a repository, you give me a feature to work on, and the condition is that I can record and publish it, and then I hopefully give you a working feature implemented onto your code base. So I did that with my friend, and he asked me exactly the same question. So this spec, is that the documentation? And I actually really didn't realize it, but you need to, I mean, I think you also asked me this last time. No, it was my friend.
This is the big problem I have at work. I can maybe explain to you the problem. But yeah, so
Sorry, I interrupted you before you
but what
explained
was
the
your
problem.
resolution? How did you, what's your approach to documentation?
I believe it should be in the repository as this is what I did for SpecLedger, right? I created doc/design that documents every layer, like what is our design philosophy, how do we organize the command line interface, how do we organize the what's the responsibility of each layer within this agentic design
Okay,
framework.
so you have a separate documentation, but who edits documentation? Agents or humans? Or both? What's your, how do you keep the
Every feature
documentation up to
needs to
date?
update the documentation. That is, the humans need to confirm and review. I mean, ultimately the agent writes the docs, but the humans need to review and can modify the docs.
So I feel partly responsible for this misalignment with my colleague. But like, for example, one thing that I like to refer to a lot is this French site called, I think I showed you this before, probably.
Yeah.
Whatever. Don't even know how to pronounce that word. We have these
Yeah,
different sort
that's
of
easy.
styles of documentation, right? So that we have some documentation at work. It's quite a lot of documentation, like at least 500 files of Markdown exported from Confluence. And what he's done is pretty good, but at the same time, it's kind of made things a bit more problematic because he's taken the 500 documentations and then he's generated a how-to guide. He's generated an information reference. He's generated some explanation documents. He's generated some tutorials from that original corpus. So now we have actually more documentation than what we had previously. And now it's like becomes like where's the source of truth?
Yeah, they become
like how do we manage this?
Now you have a broken mirror.
Well, something like that.
Yeah, because one mirror. The how-to guide is still talking about A. Well, the reference has been updated and actually it's a alpha or a beta, and now they're like slightly different. And now how to realign
exactly? Them. And that, now we have a serious alignment problem. But like my colleague he's good. I feel like that. I mean, the things he's generated are actually a lot better than what we have currently. But the trouble is like there's no way to keep things synced in my mind without running AI over every time we update this thing. Then maybe I have to have an AI job to create the tutorial or update the tutorial and update the explanation, update the reference.
And just every time you run AI, it's going to find a difference and tell you there's another difference.
Exactly. I'm already in this like Kafkaesque loop, and I can't help but think when we went back, the original documentation that we have in Confluence, even though sometimes it was wrong, at least you had the source of truth, right? Like, oh, the documentation for this particular feature is here, and that's where it is. And it's not like in four places now.
And there's also something that Opus or Sonnet or all of them like to do is when I have like, hey, we're creating this index document, and then it goes, do you want a short summary of like the other document or just a direct external link? And every time it creates a short summary, that's something that potentially gets outdated and doesn't show the original, like doesn't actually show the correct contents of what it's linking to, right? I mean, I always ask it to generate options and then ask for my alignment. And then it always gives me this option to like duplicate some of the information here and then create the link.
Yeah.
Which sounds interesting because it's kind of like progressive disclosure, right? You read a little bit and then you can go into deeper details, but it just creates another thing. Like earlier when I said the task definition is one thing, the plan kind of hinted at it and then the spec was completely different. You need to go all the way back to update all of them or you get all these misalignments.
Yeah, when you talk about spec-driven development, I do really like the source of truth element to it. I mean, I'm maybe made a brash assumption there, but with your spec driven development, like there's one document that is the source of truth for that, or there's a part of the document that's the source of truth for that feature, say, right?
Yeah, but if you so the thing, I guess it depends on which framework that you use, because I know that OpenSpec apparently has the idea of like archiving and but with the one that we currently have with SpecKit, and we haven't changed too much about it, you end up with 20 spec folders, and each one of them have a slightly iteration on top of the previous features, right? So your question earlier, like where is the source of truth? It's not in the spec folders, because you have the version 1, which was we do this initial spec with these initial features. And then we build on top of that in the second iteration. We add a bunch of new features with modify the original user story slightly. And then the third one, and we don't go back to the first one because that's the original user stories, right? So I do feel we need to have a canonical root of repo. Once the second spec is merged, all the user stories in like the root need to be aligned. So because now we have the original user story here, we have the new user story there, and we have the slightly modified original plus use changes that were introduced by the next one. So that is currently not in the spec kit, and that is something that
what?
I put in. That's not in the spec kit. That's not in.
Wait, are you in spec kit? Or, I mean, is it not in your spec ledger? Or I don't quite follow. What do
It's
you mean
not
it's not in?
a, it's no, it's not in SPECKIT. I don't know if OpenSPECK is doing it. Maybe I should investigate it further. But it's something that I put in my constitution now. Like I just explained, like I just added a docs design markdown index, and I said when we are building, we go and update this the documentation that
Wow.
defines the system, like design
Yeah, that seems like a
philosophy.
fundamental thing. It needs to be updated and it needs to be canonical. Like I was thinking naively at my workplace that we could just do what AWS Docs do. Like I don't know if you've ever used this I know you're gonna probably revolt when I say MCP, but this
No,
particular
I am controversial, right? Now everybody says MCP is that. Now I say actually I really enjoy
yeah.
MCP.
Yeah, well, this MCP AWS Docs feature, I don't know how you want this service where you can jump into Claude, set up MCP, and then ask questions about AWS Docs. It's wonderful, and this is what I wanted at work. I wanted something like this
For your
where
docs.
your docs, the canonical docs of AWS or canonical docs are queried. And the cool thing about using an AI agent like Claude is that like if you wanted a tutorial, you can say to your prompt to say like give me the steps to set up an S3 bucket with a I don't know an access point or something, and it can read the documentation. And even though it's not a tutorial, even though it's like I don't know what the AWS docs are
It can generate a
exactly,
story for you.
it can generate a tutorial. So this is what I
Yeah.
wanted at work, but the trouble is we don't have an MCP,
I don't
and
think the
we.
problem is the MCP. First off, you can, what with the CDK TF my fork, we got OSS support of Mintlify, and they provide a doc MCP out of the box out of their platform. So you put your hand crafted documentation. Actually, we have two parts of the CDK TF docs, and that's nothing we built. It's what the original CDK TF project had, which is on one side, there's the, concepts, type of information about, what's a stack, what's an aspect and all that information. And on the other side, there's an API reference, which is completely generated from the TypeScript, type definitions, from G through JSII. You get the core schema, like almost like JSON schema, TypeScript schemas, and you generate it, cross-translates it. It says for Python, it means it's like this. It uses JSII, so it generates the API reference. It's like JS Doc, Java Doc, if you remember, right? It generates this huge API reference libraries, right?
Which are
And
pretty cool. I mean,
yeah, and I think that's
they're a bit dry, but they have a lot of, yeah, it's
yeah.
interesting.
When we learned programming in school or in university, you had to go through the Java SDK
Yeah.
API docs, right?
Yeah, the
You had
PHP,
to.
I always think of the PHP docs for some reason. The PHP API docs were amazing.
We had to learn the standard library of Java, and we had to like understand all of these collection classes, string buffer, and when to use what. And you had to understand the SDK. Even when I was learning .NET, and we were learning about like threads and asynchronous, the whole threading in
Yeah,
.NET.
that's a good exercise to read through the base. Like with PHP, it was I guess I was a bit distracted half the time because the comments section of the PHP docs was always hilarious to me or very interesting.
Okay, so yeah, so but I think we can agree that we have long solved this problem, right? You put some Java doc string on your code, on your interface, on the property, and you get an auto-generated, very
Yeah,
deterministic,
but
maybe
that doesn't
dry,
give you
but
that
no,
doesn't
but
give
then
you
you,
any
but
rationale to these decisions, of course.
it depends how good you document it. But like, because if you look at AWS CDK, they actually have like very detailed in the Java doc. They have code snippets, like, sorry, in the JS doc string, JavaScript documentation string, they have a code snippet. Like, there's a constructor of the VPC L2 construct. There will be a code snippet. This is how you build a basic VPC right above the constructor. So, inside the API ref, you go to their docs. They have a right at the top introduction. This is the VPC construct. Then, little example. This is how you invoke it with
You
basic.
need to send me a link to that because it's probably
Oh,
something
yeah.
I completely missed, actually.
AWS CDK L2
Because at work we're trying to create level two constructs, and our level two constructs are basically living, the documentation's living in Confluence as an
assembly.
ADR that got signed off by security and whatnot. And I think that's what we're missing at work, actually, because the constructs, the way that they're implemented, there's very little documentation in the source code. Everything's in Confluence, and we're
So
missing a
this
lot
is
of
the
context.
API reference. So on one side you have the developer guide that explains concept that explains concepts. And then you have the completely programmatically generated API reference that you can
Okay.
view in all of the supported languages. So these language translations
Sweet,
are
sweet.
fully automated, right? And then the example I've gave, for example, was for the VPC, right? Let's go to the VPC. So if you go to the, where is he? Seriously?
Well, I'm more interested in like a level two construct or something like that.
Yeah, the VPC level 2 construct, or maybe they got rid of it. But I want to show you the level 2 construct, not the level 1. Is this, where are the level 2s? Let's just, I want to take one that I know. Like, let's take Dynamo. So DynamoDB. Oh, I know why I couldn't see it, because it's under EC2. Where did it go again? It's under EC2, but they also have the V2. AWS EC2. Okay, you're gonna have to cut a little. So here you have AWS VP EC2. You have the overview, which is the root readme of the readme.md from the library, right? In the library folder. And then you have every single construct, and this is an L2. And right in the construct here at the top, you have a little example, right? For example here, and then you have another example here. And how is this created? If you go to AWS Labs, is it AWS CDK?
Yeah, but examples,
If you go to the GitHub.
that's one form of documentation. I'm thinking like
No, hold on, let me finish.
okay.
AWS EC2. Where is EC? Oh no, it's AWS EC2. Where is the source for this? Because what we just said is that AI can generate all of this stuff, but it's like slop. So the root README is this thing, right? Which completely matches the root README here. Okay? This is import, this is examples. So that's that thing, right? Exactly the same thing. Then the second thing is you have the library. And then if you look at the actual VPC here, right in the JS doc string, you have these examples, right? In the constructor. So VPC creates a VPC. I guess there's one on the class. There's two. One is on the class. There's a JS doc on the class. This is the static import. Where is the public? Oh, there it was right there at the top. Here, so export class VPC, VPC base, and here we have the original. Like, for example, there's the VPC new. So you see, it's even like annotated TypeScript. So that's what you see at the top here. When you look at this, you see it right here. That is the JS doc, right? And then when you look, I don't know where the other example is, but I think it's here. Well, where is the actual
Well,
constructor? Here's the
I mean,
constructor.
I
Where
think
is he?
those are good for like development
No,
standard
because
library things. But like, what like often enough, we have a level two construct at work where it's for a particular business unit, for a particular feature, and it's not this sort of style. It's like there's security considerations, security reviews, and reasons why it's done this way for certain reasons and. I don't
we
think
have this is all
source code is the right
auto-generated.
place to put it, is it? I'm not too sure.
I absolutely think that as much as possible, your documentation should live life together with your code.
But like in a lot of enterprises, there's so many non-technical people involved. Like I dare say the security people are not terribly ever going to look at the code. And the product owners are definitely not going to look at the code. And the business analysts are not going to look at the code. Oh, this is the Mintlify. Is this Mintlify-driven MCP or AI feature?
Yeah, so in this case, right, I don't think I have any example in my documentation that shows you exactly how to create a Terraform stack with the S3 backend. But because of the way that these API references and everything is generated, you should get exactly this. Like, this is how you do it. And it shows us there's an API reference here and there's a backend config reference here. So this is kind of what you expect that you're getting out of the AWS MCP, right? You can ask it a question, even though that the reference data, which is auto-generated and very deterministic out of the, API contracts and open API spec, which AWS, what they have their own like Smithy
Smithy,
language
yeah.
to define API contracts. They document it very auto-generate all the documentation, and then you layer a layer of AI on top of it, and you get this type of response where you ask for an example and it gives you this. And they actually give you in the pro plan the ability to expose this as an MCP so that people can install. I don't know where is the option here.
Okay, so this is Mintlify feature, right?
Yes, these are all Mintlify features. And it kind of combats the problem of we have a whole bunch of markdown AI slop generated in five different ways. No, we have the core truth, ideally or deterministically generated from the co source code, and then we layer the AI on top, and it has a vector database, and it has indexed your docs on whenever they get published or whenever you do a library release, and then the vector database quickly
Well,
sources the data so it
I
can
like
create
this. This
something
is
like that.
great. I mean, you hear me in the sense that, like, we have a lot of non-technical people involved in these enterprises, and they just, I don't think this is a good fit for them because they live in Jira Confluence land. Like, how do I incorporate,
I mean, it depends on what is the documentation that you need to generate, right? If the
like,
documentation, what do you mean? Like, if, who owns, who has the knowledge? Who needs to write it?
well, the trouble is in a big enterprise, some people, I think the knowledge is kind of split because, like, some people have technical knowledge, like the docs and things like that, and the implementation knowledge. Some people have the business knowledge, like why it is this way because of this decision. Unfortunately, in a lot of enterprises, a lot of this information is kind of gatekept, to be honest, and it's really hard to shake out, like, why this decision is like it is and things like this. But this is the problem I'm dealing with, and I'm just starting to think it's a really challenging problem.
If it's a challenging problem, it's probably worth money. Because I think, you know how much money Mintlify has been raising? I mean, I just showed you what they can do with,
Well,
like, their.
this is the great thing about AI is, like, we're looking at problems again, and we're coming up, and there's innovation happening everywhere, and we can hardly keep track of everything. It's just incredible, and it's a really exciting space. I mean, my mood this morning is probably not great, but, like, I'm actually excited because there's so many like things to solve now. There's so many things. But let me get back to that blog that we started off with, because I think there's some really good points that are made. Like, for example, like why we review. We want to review so that there's alignment, that we have a quality. Well, I don't want to read out this text, but this is what I'm getting at. Well, this is how I interpreted this blog. I think we talked about quality, but the really interesting thing I think he makes is trust. Like, he made the point that, like, what one of the things that made Japanese stuff so good is that there was an implied quality, right? Like, if you bought this Japanese thing, it's going to be quality. So when you have that sort of expectation and trust, it makes your quality process a lot easier because you don't need to have all these checks and rigors if you know you're going to get a quality item, because it's got this Japanese label to it. But I think it's true. Like, back in the day, I don't think it's the case nowadays, because, like, Japanese products are probably not even manufactured in Japan, but who knows?
I mean, the core point is that with a label on it, it's trustworthy. But the funny thing is also
Well,
related to.
no, the label is the wrong thing. It's like the trust is there.
You know, yeah, but like it's the same. Like you trust a certification program, or you trust a security scanner, or you trust. It's a base layer of guarantees, right? That you can build upon.
Exactly.
But if you want to talk about Japan quality. When I talk about Japan quality to my father, who is 80 years old, he says it's funny because back when he was young, Japan did not have the reputation of quality, and it was like where China was maybe a few years back, where made in China was like, oh, it's not good quality. It was like that with Japan. He says also, like, they used to come to Belgium and take pictures of everything, and everyone hated it, like, because they take pictures and then they go and make it back in Japan for cheap. But it's funny now, because now made in China is actually, like, it's good quality. I don't know if you still have that connotation, but for me, made in China means it's actually futuristic, it's good quality,
Yeah, there's
it's
definitely
changed a
some things.
lot.
Like, I mean, my parents used to go to Japan in the 80s to buy fabric because there was sanctions in South Africa, and you couldn't import fabric very easily from other countries. But in Japan, they were nice to South Africa.
Contraband.
I've got a few Japanese toys, and the quality is incredible for the 80s. So there was a golden age for sure. But, like, Yeah, going back to this, going back to AI
Yeah, we
and
went off ter
teams
off topic totally.
and teams and things like this, the trust. Yeah, like I mean, I know from working with a, as being I know from being a consultant for the last 5 years at least in my current consultancy, like trust is the number one thing. Trust is the key to for a client relationship. Trust, trust, trust. And like I'm a little bit shocked in some ways that people are using AI and basically destroying that trust, because like the client doesn't know that much about AI, and then someone comes along, another a consultant says like, but if we use AI, this could be done so much quicker. And then all of a sudden, quality issues occur, and then the trust is basically destroyed. And this could be a colleague of mine. Anyway, I guess I don't really have a solution here, but like if I don't know how you even measure trust really, but this is the thing that needs to be. Anyway, this blog made me just think aloud that like trust needs to be protected. We need integrity here for whatever we do. Trust and alignment, or whatever you want to call it, is so key with all this innovation that's happening. It's just like
You know what, I
it's really
also,
hard.
you know how we used to look at CI/CD pipelines. One of the concepts of immutable infrastructure is that you build an immutable asset, and that asset or artifact moves down the pipeline. And the further along it goes to the right, the higher our trust is into this artifact until we are sufficiently convinced to deploy it into production,
Yeah,
right?
passing all the promotion gates and such and so
Yes.
forth.
And I think that's still very much like the requirements is we need verification mechanisms around
Yeah,
these.
but then, but that is in contrast, like the speed of AI and the slowness of reviews and quality gates.
Yeah, which is why everyone always says like agile, and I think we mentioned this like a long time ago, agile best practices are really important. And I think even like Adam Jacobs and all, when they talk about AI, they always say like, you know, we chef, we do agile, we do all of this, you know, DevOps best practices. We do validation mechanisms, and the focus was always on automation, right? It was always on linting to reduce the overhead, and like you know why linters exist, right? We want to remove all of the white space differences and formatting issues that people would argue over. Like no, but you know curly braces would be on the set next line, not on the same line. Linting rule. We don't want to waste our time with those discussions, right? So the more that we can put in formal and automated deterministic validation mechanisms around produced code, then the more we can trust
Avery
it.
makes the same point with Go format. Think of the people who created Go format. I don't know if you've ever worked with Go. You
Yeah.
have, right? Go format is fantastic.
And Rust expanded on that. Because then aside from Go format, Go test is also an amazing framework. You know,
Yes, it is. It's
originally
so
those
fast.
test
I love it.
frameworks, they were not in built in. Like Node didn't have a test, right? Then you have Jest,
Yeah,
then you have so many different iterations of it.
and they're slow in the oh, God.
So a
Yeah,
language that is
so.
built from the ground up with formatting, linting, testing, like Rust, Go, what else? Those languages, I mean, you have well-established frameworks for Python and for JavaScript, Jest or Vitest. So you have
So,
a lot of them, yeah.
I mean, like we know what to do in some ways, that we need to add automation, add tests, add
To build trust.
automation in the sense, add trust into these new technological advancements, AI. But I just feel like it is very challenging. Like this is what we need to do, but I feel like we need to go back to the drawing board, like make all these mistakes and then automate these things again. And that's quite challenging in an enterprise environment, which is used to being slow and used to having all this quality in place. You know, you can't just like flip the table and say, hey, we're using AI and we're going to be a startup again. And we're going to learn a lot and things like this. It's really challenging.
And I think the most important thing is that AI has been trained on the test frameworks, and we're trusting AI to write the test, and we need now to need to trust the AI to write the test. Like we don't trust the test because AI wrote it, right? And that's the
Exactly.
thing. That's where I'm excited because AWS with Kiro, right? They said the EARS format or the easy way of
Yeah,
defining.
like that's an excellent point that you made there. It's like we talk about trust, but like if we asked AI today to write us a test suite, do we trust that this test suite is
So the
actually of value? I can't.
But the problem is that the amount of, I think the problem is the volume, right? Because the volume code output is much higher, so human reviewers are overloaded. The volume of generated tests are much higher, so you can't validate that every test is really testing what you expect it to test. Are the assertions right? Is it not putting in a mock somewhere? So then you're shifting the abstraction layer, right? Because when you talk like low-level assembly, it's a massive volume, right? We used it by going up in the abstraction layer. And I think that's where then now with AI, we're able to live at a much higher abstraction layer, the English language, and we are defining our user stories and we're defining our tests in the English language, right? So things that were not possible in the past, automatically parsing English language into validation framework, become a little bit more realistic now because of AI has the ability to interpret a paragraph, generate a text that is easy for a human to understand and validate, formally then convert that into an actual rule like property-based testing or Gherkin, BDD, these frameworks, which exist for years, and everybody, maybe you will write them off, say, yeah, we tried, but it didn't work. We tried, it didn't work, but there was no AI.
But I mean, Vincent, when I'm listening to you, it sounds like the solution to the problem is AI. Like if only we had AI
No, the solution to the
pro
problem is to apply AI to higher layer and then have a deterministic parsing. Like we're parsing a formal language down to
But
a
that higher
framework.
layer requires agents to do the
No, the parsing down
translation.
will not. Okay, so imagine this, right? The way that Kiro is designed is to define a user story. From those user story, like as a developer, I want this because of this. This is a primary reason why I want to do this, blah, blah, blah. There gets functional requirements. When I do this, then this happen, like happy path. When I do this, then that should not happen, like sad path. These are very, very parsable strings of text, right? They're an in-between. They're from the user story, which is like a paragraph of test, to actual bullet points of rules,
Yeah, but like,
requirements that are parsable. The parsable part means deterministic, means we don't let an AI generate the
but
test from it.
you still need some
Yeah, but as a
a
human,
test harness to run that, and the AI could.
no, the AI should not be involved there at all. The
But
test harness.
how do you execute these requirements against the
So
implementation? I
that's
don't
the
understand.
concept of Cucumber and Gherkin, BDD, behavior-driven test, behavior-driven development. They have defined a markdown format that can be parsed down into a validation framework. So the AI agent writes English in those specific strings, and then you fail the parser if it doesn't match that format. Or you pass the parser and it generates a deterministic validation framework.
I
Your role as
still
a human is to validate those requirements.
okay.
And if you fail that, then you cannot trust the completely deterministically generated test. There's no AI from that point.
Okay, I think I need to. Maybe you should try conjure an example for me, because I guess I'm lacking the trust, because I just feel that the AI is smart enough to circumvent that in a way. Like for example, like, hear me out here. Like the way I usually test some work when I'm working with the AI stuff is that I introduce a bug to make sure that my test harness sort of caught it, and that for me gives me the reassurance that these tests that were generated are doing are capturing the bug, right? You know what I mean? Like there's probably a name for this. Like I basically randomly enter a bug and make sure that the
Kiro does that, and they call it property-based testing. It's basically like fuzzing, right? You generate a whole bunch of variables, and you test the rules, the invariants against those variables, and you basically generate, like programmatically, randomly, all the possible inputs until you
Yeah,
find a counterexample.
I understand what fuzzing is. It's just that the like my sort of review process is to sort of spot check, introduce not so much like a boundary problem, more like something more fundamental. Well, I say that, and I can't even think of a good example right now. But that's where my mind is going when it comes to testing. It's like you are given something to review. There's so much volume, as we were saying, with the code and the tests. And then you almost have to go in there, break something, just to validate what this PR is trying to do, or something like that.
Yeah, so I had a discussion with Ian Murdoch about this, where I keep saying like we need to have Gherkin or BDD, because this is my one of the approaches. Like I said, over the last few days, I realized that the constitution wasn't there, the checklist wasn't there, the cross-reference verify wasn't there. That's all AI agent driven, right? But my original idea was assuming that they were all there. Even if they were there, they all failed because AI is unreliable. So my
Unreliable, untrustworthy.
yeah. And so I always want to explore this, basically what I heard or understood Kiro was doing. And when I talked to Ion, he said putting more rules and formal methodology around these agents is constraining them too much. You're just gonna get worse output because the agents are working because of their ability to I guess have freedom to execute. And the more you start throwing errors at them when they run, the more they get distracted and the less they can, you know, perform and give you the output that you want. Because my assumption is like I'm gonna just immediately throw an error if it doesn't pass, right? So he said too many rules, even like too many injecting error messages when things are not according to certain expectations is not gonna improve the performance of the agents in a way. That's what I understood from him. But I feel like I need to try it. I also wonder why I haven't really seen that in Kiro. I saw a lot of presentations from AWS talking about how they do this, like deterministically validating. But I haven't really seen a lot of actual examples of that. So there must be a
Well,
reason why it doesn't work, right?
it's not a solved problem. It's not a solved problem by any means. Anyway, I got to take my kids to school now. Anyway, it's a thought-provoking discussion. Thank you again, Vincent.
I want to try. I mean, in terms of giving you examples, it's definitely my intention to build like a Gherkin parser into SpecLedger. And basically, whenever the agent writes down the requirements, run the parser. If the requirements don't pass, feed it back to the agent, say, like, okay, great, you wrote all the specs, but there's a parsing error on the requirements. I
I mean,
can't validate this.
instinctively, I'm thinking just like everything in the world, I feel like that human t that the hu like a human needs to be at the beginning and a human needs to be at the end. There's got to be a relationship there. There's got to be trust. And I'm thinking that like when you take the artifact off the production line, there needs to be that human review before it goes out
Stamp of
there.
approval.
Exactly. That QA mark.
The
That's
human
where my
that signed the contract and that's held responsible if the thing
Yeah,
blows up.
exactly. Insurance, the insurance policy and things like that. I
The guy that gets
feel
paid $20,000 a month or more, like
well, actually, maybe not the insurance
$50,000.
thing. I do find that horribly bureaucratic. I hate the whole insurance industry. But yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from. I hope you're right in a way. I hope you're right. Though at the same time, I'm just thinking to myself that
Hope I'm wrong because where did the human what's the human role if it can be the human role seems to be the only thing that generates the ideas and then the whole process is completely AI. There's no like if you can completely trust a framework that it builds exactly according to what the
well, like
spec.
there could be another test. Like for example, there might not be like a tedious QA stamp, but there could be a test, a market test. Like if this product is good, then humans will buy it, and that is the ultimate test, of course.
I wanted to show something, but you have to go. I also next time you have to show me. I'm gonna watch your experimentation with Swamp and see if I am convinced.
Yeah. Please do, and please ask questions. Okay, so let's just wind this up. Oh my gosh, I think I need to do an intro in the beginning.
Yeah, you can add it. I have to say, Riverside is really nice because the video was recorded directly from my machine and it's uploading. Quality is much higher. Audio is really good. Second
Okay,
thing is, it's gonna give you audio channels. So you can mute me if you want to talk. I can mute. I mean, you can. I did it with my friend. I was saying something while he was talking, or he was talking when I was saying something. You can mute it. So
Okay, I gotta
individual
go.
audio channels. Perfect, right?
Okay, I'll do an intro. So, yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. And hopefully, this Riverside works really well. See you. Bye. I'm clicking stop.